This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us Patrick Nolan,
Dawn Nolan,
Alison Nolan,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Patrick, you're from this area, but you actually became a beef eater in the Tower of London.
Yeah, it was a bit more complex than that, actually. I was born in Marton, and then my family went to stay with my granddad, who was a farming out of Mataroa, which is north of Taihape. And from there we went to Kaupaki in the King Country, and coming then down to Bunnythorpe. We got there in 1950 when I was about four, rising five. Went to school at Bunnythorpe School. And then the following year I went to St. Mary's. We were a Catholic family. And went to St. Mary's in Palmerston North, just opposite the hospital in Ruahini Street there. From there we schooled to Marist, and then I went to high school at Queen Elizabeth Technical College, as it was then called, referred to as Tech. It had just shifted from Grey Street, no, it had just shifted from Queen Street, I think, down that part of town, and then up to Rangitiki Street, where it is now. I didn't enjoy schooling very much. All I wanted to do was sit down and read books. And I was a, must have been a little bugger. A disruptive element. And I was cordially invited to sever my ties with the education department at the ripe old age of 14.
And when was this?
1960-ish.
Okay.
Yeah. I was kept out of trouble. I started my apprenticeship with the Extension Ladder Company, Palco, when I turned 15 in February of, 61. February of 61, yeah. And it just didn't work. The local policeman in Bunnythorpe,
Jack Dorr,
he kept an eye on me, I suppose. A rather benign eye. And he kept me out of trouble until later in the year I signed up with the regular force cadet scheme, which was a very, very good scheme in retrospect of looking. They took 100 boys aged up to 17. They taught us trades, they moulded us. We were called the chosen few. 5% of those who applied for it actually were selected to go to Wairu. We did trades, artillery trades, there was infantry trades. I was carried on and finished my carpenter and joiner trade.
What was the aim of it then? Was it
to produce leaders for the army, to produce good, solid citizens for New Zealand, and well-qualified tradesmen. In the morning we did schooling and then reading, writing, arithmetic. In the afternoon we did trade practice, and in the evenings we studied for our trade exams, the New Zealand Trade Certification Board, and we'd study for that by correspondence. We were actually at a school that had government accreditation, and as a consequence, that was a polytech, so we didn't have to go to block courses in tech in Wellington or Palmerston North.
And you're all living in barracks?
Yeah, and 100 boys. We graduated at 18, so you had to do a minimum of 1 year. We did soldier skills as well, of course. Yeah.
So it was all in uniform all the time?
Yeah, no, we were just little soldiers.
Yep.
I started to come right there, I think. The attitude changed.
The attitude changed. You mean rebellious beforehand, or
my attitude changed? Yeah. I stopped being a little smarty. Mm-hmm. Then, on attaining the age of 18, I then joined man service, the regular army. Although I'd done 2 years, 2 months, and 4 days in boys' service, not that I was counting. Mm. And was posted to Wairu Workshop, which meant that my barracks moved and my place of work moved, but all within Wairu. At this stage, it was a big town. People don't realise we had 1,100 children at the primary school. It was a very big area. Jim Bolger later on was the Prime Minister, and we were in his electorate, and he came down sort of flexing his muscles, I suppose, just before an election, and someone suggested that he, as Prime Minister, should spend a bit more time in his big towns. And it was pointed out to him that if we voted as a bloc, he would lose his job. We could vote him out of office. Mm. The electoral system was different to what it is today. Then I went to Papakura. At this stage, I had a nice warm little workshop in Wairu, and I was quite happy pottering on.
You were doing woodwork?
Yeah, carpenter.
So making what sort of things?
Army trucks, wooden, anything to do with wood. I was the only carpenter in Wairu. I became a glazier pretty quickly. Oh, just as an aside, we had a couple of officers were having a dispute over a couple of drinks, should we say, at a formal dinner. And it wound up with the artilleryman running down or he wound up with an artillery piece on the back of a Land Rover that he was busy taking down, but the armoured chap had popped down and he had got himself a tank. So he was driving down the road about 2 o'clock in the morning in his tank, and he put the barrel of the gun through the porch of the officer's mess, which is quite an impressive bit of driving after one has, should we say, a drink taken. And he opened the breech on the gun and he inserted a blank round. And he, with a cry of "artillery be damned," he went bang with the blank. No one heard anything for about, an hour, maybe 2 hours, I suppose. And I wound up reglazing 180 windows, because all of the glass just sort of popped out and fell on the ground. But this sort of thing did have an attack of boredom. I'd spent 5 years in Wairu as a single man. Mm. And very few people had cars in those days. So we went to Papakura. The artillery had been sent to Vietnam about 18 months earlier than this. And being a peacetime army, it was pared down to its almost non-existent peacetime levels. Good old politicians again. And they were having to reinforce the battery because most of them had been there for 12, some of them getting on for 15 months, and they needed to be reinforced. So there were not enough artillerymen to reinforce them, so they opened it up to regular soldiers who could have been trained soldiers who could be taught an artillery trade, and then we could go as artillerymen. So I left my little workshop and popped over to Papakura. I qualified very, very quickly. The courses ran pretty close together, and I qualified very quickly, having some spare time, as it were. I had the opportunity to do a parachute course in Whenuapai. At this stage, I was jumping out of aeroplanes for fun, way back in the 60s. We were the sort of pioneers, I suppose, of the sport. Out at Whenuapai, I met this charming young lady and pursued her with much ardour, and she managed to catch me. And a little later, we got married. I went to Vietnam shortly after this as an artilleryman. I was a forward observer, and I patrolled through the jungle with infantrymen doing an infantryman's job, and should there be a requirement to have support supplied to them, I was part of the supply system. And so
was there much action that you were involved in?
Oh, enough to keep it interesting. Yeah. Came home, and Dawn had a baby. So we, at this stage, were given an army house, and also a posting to Linton. And of course we had to go on the housing list again. I could either leave Dawn in Papakura and go down on my own, or we went down there and we had a house in Highbury. It was defence housing or government housing. We had policemen and Massey University lecturers as our neighbours in Highbury. And we didn't have television in those days. Just looking out the window on a Friday and Saturday was interesting enough, because I'm afraid Highbury was not the most salubrious part of Palmerston North to live. We had another child, and then we got posted to Naruawahia. Just north of Naruawahia town, there was a military establishment, very old one. It was going in the 1880s, the Hopewopu camp.
Well, that was a compassionate posting, because our second son had died when he was 20 months. So to give us a change of scenery, they sent us to Naruawahia, which wasn't very compassionate. I think Singapore would have been better.
Yeah.
That was my idea of compassion, but Naruawahia was quite an eye-opener.
Oh, in what sense?
Well, there was tremendous wages being earned at the freezing works, and some of the worst poverty, far worse than anything I've seen pretty much anywhere. Money was all going to the horses and the pubs.
Oh, right.
It was Vietnam, actually, some of the poverty there.
It was quite appalling. I used to take my kids' cast-offs that weren't fit for them to wear anymore, and the kids from the Marae would be bathed in the tub at the kindergarten and then put into clean clothing. Mm. You know, it was dreadful.
So sad.
So it was the culture, just the lifestyle of the people?
Just lifestyle. Yeah. Big earners, big spenders.
And big drinkers. Because this is 50 years ago.
So were the military quite separate from that community?
No, we were a total organisation 3.5 km up the road. As you're going north, you do actually go over the rail bridge. It's just south of Taupuri.
It was a nice little camp. It was a bit like Fielding that kept winning the prettiest town.
Well, the commandant was a gardener. And he would sort of, as the boss, he would sort of catch your eye and say, Norm could do with a bit of a mow, Mr. Norm. Or you'd get in there, there'd be 4 or 5 pot plants sitting by your letterbox, and you knew fair well that they had to go into the garden because the boss had put them there. So we won the pretty town of Waikato, small town. It was a lovely, lovely little oasis of serenity. And anyway, we were posted from there and we went to Papakura.
No, we went to Waiuru.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, that was exciting. Yeah, so where did we go after that? Then we went to Papakura.
Then we went to Papakura, then we went to Singapore, then we came back to Waiuru, and then we went to Burnham, and then we came back to Waiuru, and then we went to Trentham, and you retired.
Dawn's had 43 homes.
43 changes of address.
In our married life.
Yeah. And your children then, how did they take
They had 9 things? Schools each. But they'd go from one school to another, and people that they'd known from 2 schools ago would be there.
Incestuous New Zealand.
When we went to Singapore, there was a New Zealand school. Or I think we had Australians there too. There was a few Australians. New Zealand teachers, New Zealand curriculum, and the school, the boys went there. And it was very good for them, very educational, being in foreign country. It was safe. It was incredibly safe for them to walk around Singapore by themselves, get the bus somewhere.
With our allowances, it made life an awful lot easier as well. The boys could go at 9 o'clock at night down to the local bar restaurant area, and I would not worry at all. This 11-year-old boy could go down on his own at night to
get a soft drink or some fried rice. It was actually cheaper to eat at the local makan stalls than it was to buy sausages and potatoes and cook at home.
And makan is the Malay word for food.
Chuka Malay. Do you speak Malay?
No, just a few words.
We had a wonderful job there. What happened in Singapore?
Patrick was working with an awful lot of local people. It was for maintenance and looking after the houses occupied and buildings occupied by the New Zealand military. So we got to socialise with them, with the local people.
Every one of my immediate team came to my place, our place, and took a meal with their families. And we, of course, went and reciprocated with them. It was fun, actually. What's her name? Marco Polo. Bestick. Colonel Bestick was the the infantry commander. And his wife gave me a ring and she said, I've got a problem with my downstairs fridge. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, goodness me, this doesn't sound too good. I'll bring you another one out, because that was part of my tasking. And she said, oh, no, it's all right, but you better come and have a look. So I put a new fridge on the back of the Colonel's wife, Mrs. Colonel. So away we went. And they lived up in the neck of a gully, their home. And all on the banks down the side were all of the armors, the maids. There was the kibbons, the gardeners. There were the boot boys. And there were all manners of people sitting on tiers up this bank. And as I walked in, they were saying things like, oh, careful, isn't she very, very dangerous? Oh, you know, poisonous, you'll die. What the hang's going on? So we went down, and Mrs. Bestick had got this cobra who had popped in the cool of the night and curled up on top of the motor of the refrigerator and had got the tail end of his tail stuck between the pulley and the fan belt. Mm-hmm. And as it was under pressure, it wouldn't turn off. So it kept on going, and this was pinching the snake's tail, and he, of course, was getting very, very upset about it. Now, this is our cat, Polly, who can bite as good as any cobra. So we had a bit of a think about this, and I was going to bug bomb the cobra into submission until I had a really good look at him. But so I thought, well, I'll do it from fill up the whole room, because he was as thick as my leg and probably 3 metres long. He was a big bit of angry, bitey thing. So we figured out that I could grab the broom and I could flick the switch off. Mm-hmm. And that, with any luck, might just release it. Well, it worked out that way, and it did. Mm-hmm. So the old fridge went sort of, and the snake went out of the wash house. Oh, I was going to shoot it. And Mrs. Bestick said, don't you dare shoot it. We haven't had a rat in the house since he's been there. And when we let the fridge off, turned it off, and the snake went off, and he was about a metre off the floor with the speed of light. And as he went out through the door, you couldn't see where these people had been sitting on the bank. There must have been 50 of them. You couldn't see one of them. They were all you could see was fast-moving flip-flops as they disappeared into the sunset. And 3 days later, the snake was back, and Mrs. Bestick was quite happy because, as she said, he did keep the... Oh, golly. Yeah, so that was Singapore. Came home, posted to Waiuru again. It was just the sort of the peacetime army.
Yeah. So what was the sort of army community like? Was it very hierarchical then, or very orderly all the time?
It was orderly through the military discipline. There was... all the soldiers were pretty well paid. Booze was cheap. There was a duty-free port. So we all had the chance of getting a foot up. The posting to Singapore was... some infantry people were getting sick of it. You know, they sort of... Singapore for 2 years, home for 2 years, Singapore for 2 years, home for 2 years. But for people in my position and the electrical and mechanical engineers, we didn't get the overseas postings that often. So it was great for us. We bought a new car and a lot of furniture and crockery. It did set us up, really. The opportunity was there to save, but goodness me, who's going to save? There's so much to see, so many places to go to.
So you travelled a lot in free time?
Yeah, 4 years. We worked or I even judged a couple of international skydiving meets. Huh. And that was quite fun. Met the king of
Malaysia,
the Argonne. Yeah, it was fun. Huh. And when you come home, everybody's jealous of your big flash car. Huh. And you can get over that very, very quickly.
The car that we bought back was a Mazda Legato, and it was beautiful, and there was only ever 60 bought to New Zealand. It was big enough that you could sit the two boys, one each end of the seat, and they couldn't breathe on each other. They were totally separate. But when we arrived back, I hadn't been familiar with automatic cars. I'd never driven one. So there was a bit of thud and blunder involved with learning. And I didn't know that if you parked in neutral, you had to put the handbrake on or the car would roll backwards into the nearest monsoon drain. And I had three close encounters with monsoon drains.
And my driver, Mr. Sim Poon Sun, he said to me one day, I saw Missy driving your car in cheek. I said, oh, did you really? She is so good, she is so confident, and she can drive so fast.
Mr. Sim came with Patrick to help pull me out of one of the drains, and he said, you must keep cool. a cool head and a warm heart.
But now, anyway, you're talking about monsoon drains. Those are big, deep.
Well, they ranged from great big that you could put half a garage into it, down to sort of about a foot deep. Just the width of the car tyre wide, they were round the house to drain off all the water. And I was dodging a skateboard and put a wheel into the drain there. And the back wheels, they went into a smaller drain. And the third time, one of the wheels went off a little bridge over a big monsoon drain down by Sembawang Strook. And all the Indians came out of one of the shops, about 10 of them, to lift the car up, put it back on the bridge.
And then the whisper goes round and round and round and round.
And everybody knows Missy Nolan put the car in the drain. When we came down to, I went down to Trentham, I still had the car, and someone drove into us in McDonald's, and they were unregistered, unlicensed, unwarranted, and high on chemical substances, so no insurance. And we had our first meeting with a Trentham panel beater, and I picked the car up a few days later, drove it home and stopped to get the mail out of the letterbox. The neighbour drove backwards out of her garage straight into the part that had just been panel beaten. So we had to wait for another part to come out from Japan.
Dawn had a very good working relationship with the panel beaters.
This is part one of five. Tune in next week for part two.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.